Stop kicking the rubbers. Who do you think you are, kid?
Collecting your charge.
Yes. Did you ever kick a rubber before in a pinball machine? So play it, then you can.
Welcome to Playable Character. I'm your host, Sean Ryder. In this episode, we spend a day at the National Pinball Museum. We talk to folks around the museum, as well as the museum's creator, executive director, and curator, David Silverman, to find out how one man's collection of over 800 pinball machines turns into a national fixture in Washington, D.C. Thanks a lot for joining us. Let's go play a game.
My name is Alan.
Alan, great. And this is
T-Man.
T-Man, how you doing, T-Man? Are you a big pinball fan in general?
Sort of. I own one game. It's an old pinbot machine, and I'm actually restoring it myself. So, you know, to come and see the older pinball machines, I really didn't know a lot about them, but now it's a lot more than I thought it was.
That's pretty exciting. Do you play other video games and stuff, or?
Yeah, I play all sorts of games, software engineer, so I'm into like computer games like PlayStation and stuff like that, but you know, the physical games are kind of sort of more real.
Yeah, excellent. And how does T-Man like it here? Are you?
Oh, he loves them. He loves pinball because it's sort of real. He likes playing with marbles and stuff like that, so this is kind of like marbles on steroids.
The physicality of the pinball machine is certainly one of its main attractions. All over the museum, families huddle around tables. Dads show kids how to bump without tilting, or how to juggle the ball on the flippers. Visitors ooh and ah as they rediscover machines they recognize from their youths. For many of the kids visiting the museum, pinball is not a part of their day-to-day life. This visit allows them to experience something their parents intimately associate with growing up, but which has largely been replaced for this generation by Xboxes and Nintendos. For other visitors, the museum must seem a lot like a classic car show. Pinball attracts its share of gearheads who love the idea of restoring old machines back to a playable state. It's not just about the playing of the game, but how these historically significant machines can be kept alive for players to experience in the future. That's why the Dillon brothers have come to the National Pinball Museum.
Raleigh Dillon.
I'm Luke Dillon. We're brothers.
Okay. Are you guys visiting here? Are you from around here?
We're from Roanoke, actually.
Yeah, from Roanoke. Excellent.
About 3 hours.
Uh-huh. Doing a whole D.C. tour, or did you come up specifically
for just for here. We specifically took a day trip just to come here.
So are you guys are big pinball fans in general?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he got his first machine about 2 years ago, and that kind of, like, gave us a boom into it. And we've got, like, seven of our own now. So yeah, we wanted to come and check out some new prospects, even see if we want to get one of these, or not specifically these, but one of these games.
Uh-huh. We'd like to start a business with, like, some pinball machines and stuff.
Excellent. Yeah, checking everything out.
How many places are there down in Roanoke to play pinball?
Like, not none.
You might find one machine here and there, like the flea market. You might find one at a laundromat, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's tough.
We have to travel to buy, like, decent ones.
Wow. Do you guys play other games? Are you video gamers at all?
Yeah, for the most part.
Excellent. Him more so than me. But, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, we like video games.
So did you come to pinball through video games, or video games through pinball, or are they totally separate in your minds?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is just recent, but we've always loved pinball.
Yeah, this is pretty recent, but, like you said, we've always played it. Anytime we saw one anywhere, we at least had to get one play on it to see if we liked it or not. And
then, sure.
You know, sometimes it stuck, but a lot of times it was just on, like, road trips we'd find them. That's how we played most of the ones we played when we were younger, so. Mm-hmm.
Medieval Madness. We found a few of those in our time.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Excellent. Was pretty awesome. If you know anything about pinball, it's like one of the top.
Yeah, yeah.
We're lucky to even be able to play one somewhere.
What are some of your other favorite like games or games that you own that you're proud to own? Or
Doctor Who. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we just got a Fishtails. That's pretty awesome. Yeah. And Dirty Harry. Is hard. I really like that. Yeah, Fishtails is ridiculous.
Really like Johnny Mnemonic. We got that one.
That's a great game, man.
Yeah. I mean, so, I just love movies. When you hear a good sound bite at the right time, it's just priceless.
Excellent.
They had a lot of those. Like Indiana Jones, we'd love to have one of those one day. The,
yeah,
the Williams. Yeah, that's awesome.
A big one.
The story the Dillon brothers tell is not so different from David Silverman's story, which is to say, pinball has a way of working on some human hearts to engender an incredible dedication and affection. I asked him to begin at the beginning and tell us how all of this came to be.
When I was a kid of four, my father gave me a Roland Nichols, and we were on vacation in upstate New York on an island called, we were on an island called Big Burnt in a Lake George. And we would periodically take the boat into the mainland, and there was a town in Bolton Landing that had a bunch of pinball machines that, I never saw a pinball machine before as a young kid. So he gave me a Roland Nichols, and he said, here, go play this. And I became really fascinated with the game because I'd never played it, but also with the artwork. I was just really curious to see each game's fonts and calligraphy was different from the next one. So I'd actually sit down with a little pad of paper and I'd draw the font. I mean, I was like a little nutty kid, and I was just kind of like, that game was Big Ben, and it had blocky letters, and this one, and this one. So all of them were different, but of course I loved playing. And I always wished I had one more ball to get that special, which is what meant you got a free game. So I'd always kind of keep trying to get better and better and better. So over the years, anytime I saw a pinball machine, I would play it. And as I grew up, it wasn't a mania, it was just something that I really was fascinated with. And so when, you know, growing up, we go on another vacation, I see them another place and play them, and I'd go different places with my cousins, because I grew up in the Bronx, and New York City, it was against the law to have pinball. So upstate New York, it was fine, and in other locations, we would find them. I guess then I went to college, and the dormitory had pinball machines in the basement of the dormitory, so I'd play them, and you'd play against your friends and stuff like that. So I always watched the development of pinball through playing them. And of course, each one of them developed more features.
We have to come back.
Yeah. Well,
how long are you here?
At this moment, I'll be here.
This happens throughout our conversation. Patrons hear David telling the story of the museum, and they are compelled to speak with him. You see, not all is well in pinball land, and many of the visitors today have heard the news, which is why they are here.
Negotiating the things I didn't do before, because I wouldn't be here if I did the negotiating back then. So I've learned my lesson. A $300,000 lesson, but I learned my lesson. So thank you very much.
This is amazing.
I love it.
Wish we had more time.
Yeah.
Well, come back before July 4th, or I'll give you a personal tour on July 5th.
We'll do our best.
Okay. Bye. So someone is beating the shit out of a pinball machine. I can hear them. So as I got older, I played more pinball in different locations. The first pinball machine I ever bought was when I was teaching in Ohio, in Ohio University. And there was an advertisement in a newspaper, and I bought it for $200. It actually was a game called Subway. And then I bought another one, and I had two, and I learned about them because I had to repair them and, you know, see you take them apart and you start looking inside of them. So it was an interesting hobby. It was a fascination to see how these worked. And I actually did some art shows based on relationship between pinball and history and all kinds of stuff when I was teaching. And then I moved here about 34 years ago, and I bought a little house and I was teaching, and I kept driving by a place called Rockville Home Amusements, which I kind of, I was tempted to go in every time I drove by because I knew they probably have pinball machines. But I was also concerned that if I walked in, it would be like the last vestige of sanity. And so after probably a year, I finally did go in, and it was the end of my sanity. Pinball had really developed. It switched from what's called electromechanical games to solid state games, which can add more modernization to a game because the electronics are much different and you don't need as many wires, etc., etc. So I went into this place and the games in there just blew me away. I remember the game that really knocked my socks off was a game called The Addams Family, because it was exactly like the movie. I had seen the movie. I thought the movie was hysterical. And it had all these different levels, and people talked in the game, and there were lights and music and all kinds of stuff, which never was in these earlier games. And there was a game there that I had played when I was in Spain called Fireball, and I still own that game. And that was the game that I asked if it was for sale, and they said yes, and I bought it. And basically, from that day forward, till today, I started buying pinball machines. I originally bought them just strictly as a hobby. You know, I'd like to play a game. I got tired of it because I played it like 100 times, 200 times. So I said, well, I need another game. And instead of like turning it in, I just bought another game. Now, they weren't exorbitantly expensive back then, but they still were not cheap. But at the time, I was still teaching, so I had some kind of extra income. I wasn't certainly spending the money that was needed for, by that time I had been got married, and so I wasn't, you know, overspending all the money, but they started to accumulate, and you know, after a number of years, there was quite a lot of them, and then about 15 years after I had started collecting, I kind of took stock of the situation. I said, "What are you going to do? You have like 300 pinball machines." In the 15 years of my collecting, I basically had come to realize that there was very little written literature or history that was documented about pinball. There were a few books, but there really were not a lot of stuff. So I started researching and going to conferences and meeting some of the people who were part of the pinball lore, you know, that had been manufacturers, who had been workers there, etc. So when I decided to take stock of this situation, I said, I think pinball really needs a museum. This was a truly American pastime that represented the art of America for you know, actually, this year is the 140th anniversary of the plunger on a pinball game. And so all of this information was out there in different forms, and I felt it was really a necessity to put this together. So it really changed the whole focus I had on what pinball was about. Instead of collecting or buying games for just the fun of it, I started to now collect games for representing and creating a collection for a museum. And that was a very different way of working, because as I said before, I was just getting a game because I liked what it looked like or it played interesting. Now I was buying games because they had a significance historically, artistically, to the history of pinball. And so from that point on, I really started to look for games that had like the first flipper, the games that had the first bumper, the games that had the first wooden legs, metal legs, you know, all strategic points in pinball history, as well as kind of American history, because pinball seemed to be kind of a reflection of its history. So if, you know, a spaceship went up, they made a pinball machine about spaceships. If the Queen Elizabeth was coronated, they made a game about coronation. So everything that was going on with modern history was being represented with pinball machines. I started really looking for these specific games because I felt they were going to be important to show the history of pinball. So I collected games very seriously for probably the next 15 years. So by the end of 30 years, I had between 700 and 800 machines. And then I started to really kind of push toward building, actually trying to tell people what I was trying to do. And we built a website, and a fairly decent website. A guy called me who said he was, he had an idea and he wanted to meet with me. And by that time I had built a number of buildings in my backyard, and two I actually built. One was to show people the games that I had restored, and the other one was actually to have parties, because we had had a party for my best friend at the time, and it was his bachelor party. And so the guys played games, and my wife said to me, why don't you, you know, this seems like a perfect way of raising money. Why don't you build a building that has a bathroom and a kitchen in it so that you could really have parties in it? I hear one of the games exploding as usual. And so I actually built a second building which was added onto it. And so then I would have people come. Let me turn that off, because that's going to explode.
David's attention is clearly divided between telling me his story and keeping an eye on the pinball machines. It's as if he can tell each individual machine by the sound of the plunger, the flippers, and the bells. He makes a beeline towards an old plungerless game in another room where two women are rolling balls up the glass to drop them at the top of the table. These old tables remind me very much of Japanese pachinko games. As soon as one game is fixed, another malfunctions. Keeping up with vintage pinball machines requires the love of a devoted maintenance man. The next machine to act up is Bankshot, and it's a table that holds notable position in pinball history. David offers up not only a fix, but also a history lesson for the hapless visitor.
That guy over there?
Yeah.
His name is Roger Sharp. He's on our board of directors. He's the guy playing this exact game.
Huh?
And this is the game that made pinball legal.
Really?
Yep. In 1975. Before then, pinball was illegal. That's the New York City Council. He said to them, I'm going to use this flipper and shoot it in that hole and get a free game. And it did. And that showed that pinball was a game of skill, not a game of gambling. And from that point on, pinball was legalized in New York City and then in Chicago and in L.A. So you get 5 balls to become a star. So 5, and it'll go down 4. So there you have it, for free. In this place, nothing's for free. So I met this guy, and he had a music venue at a place called Meriwether Post, which is in Columbia, Maryland. And his idea was that in between the musical acts, why not have pinball machines related to music that people can play? And I said, it sounds like a great idea. So I made him a whole list of these games. We set up a space. It drew a lot of publicity. So it's called the National Pinball Museum presents the Music Pinball Hall of Fame, and there are 9 games up there. Boy, there's a lot of angry people in this room. That brought me some publicity. Then the Baltimore Sun, then the Washington Post, then NPR, then the Smithsonian, so I kept getting this publicity, and then people started offering me places to build my museum, because my appeal was that I got out of my backyard and went into a decent-sized place. But most of the offers were out of state, and I had no desire to move. My son was in school. I built my own house. It was not I wanted to be in this area. I thought Washington was the perfect place for museums. So then, this woman calls me from the Shops at Georgetown Park, where we're sitting. And she is the representative for the rental agency for this place. And after some negotiations, they gave us this spot for free. For a 2-year lease. April, we signed the lease. In June, we started to build. And I had a carpenter friend who was a pretty heavy-duty builder. He had done lots of work for my landscape company, and he had built buildings and stuff. So I knew he had the capability of transforming this dump into a place that we could really have as a pinball museum. And I was very strongly of the belief that a museum should be a space that gives back to the public, that it teaches and it educates, meaning classrooms, all kinds of different things. And I didn't want to build an arcade. I was much more building in a real museum in terms of showing the history, the art, the quality of art, the changes of art styles, the history of the game, the history of our country through pinball. And so we started building, and we started in June. We didn't finish until December, and December 4th we opened. And I can tell you, from June to December, I was a basket case, because I was designing the space as well as building it, because I knew certain things lent itself well to what I wanted, because we have a library, we have a theater, we have a game room, we have a history room, we have a gift shop, we have a cash register area, you know, so there's a lot of things I knew where I wanted them to be, but there were a lot of stuff I didn't, so we were building and designing at the same time. And so I wanted to build it with a lot of different exhibition areas that would change, different games would come in, different themes would be happening, and I wanted a pinball walk, a kind of a history of the most significant steps in the modernization of pinball. Well, while we were building, as things started to, little pieces of evidence started to come through that this place was going to be in trouble. But I didn't know that, you know, at the time, because the people who I had been dealing with were saying, there's no problem. But the mall went bankrupt. It filed for Chapter 11, and it was sold on auction. So right in the middle of building it, they're telling me that they're not going to be here. But the leasing agent people said, oh, no problem, because we're going to stay the leasing agent and all that kind of stuff. Well, it all turned to shit because basically the leasing agency was fired. And for the next 4 or 5 months, this new company, which took over in October, basically had nothing to do with anybody. They just basically kept it afloat, the whole mall, with the intention of renovating, but we had no sense of what this was going to be about. So we started getting nervous about a month ago, because we knew our lease was coming due in December, and we hadn't even been open 5 months, so we wanted to see if we could extend our lease. So we talked to one person who told us to talk to another, until we finally got to the people who knew what was going on. And instead of saying they could extend our lease, they actually said, you're out in December. This whole mall is shutting down. We're ripping the whole inside out of the mall. So that was a really major blow to this museum, because we were just starting to get ourselves known in Georgetown, and you know, we had a limited amount of funds after building this space, so we couldn't publicize as much as we wanted to. And now they're telling us we have to get out of here. And this cost me a ton of money. And how was I going to be able to recoup this money unless we ended up finding another place? So after we kind of got over that shock, within a week of that knowledge that we have to be out by December, we get a letter that says, we're taking a little clause in your contract that says we can get you out in six weeks. And we're taking you up on that. So they give us 6 weeks to get out. Which we just like, I mean, I was like basically in a state of shock. This took 6 months to build. Trying to get out in 6 weeks is like impossible, no matter how many people you have. So we appealed by writing a letter to the new company who owns this mall. And I got a phone call last week from one of the representatives saying, yes, they've agreed to extend our lease till September. So we haven't gotten that in writing, and that's what we're supposed to be getting, is this letter in writing that says that, and for us to sign it, et cetera, et cetera. So in the interim, what we've been doing is desperately going around, contacting every person we know, or who knows someone who knows someone who knows someone, to try to find a new place. So we've been going to different places all over the area, Maryland, Virginia, other areas in DC, trying to find a new place. In the interim, what we've done is we've lowered our price so that we could actually get as many people in the space as possible before it closed, so they could see what it was like. Because I personally, and not just because I designed it, but I think it's a pretty amazing space. It's probably the first pinball museum that really covers all areas of the game. Most of the people coming here have never known that it comes from France and had all these different beginnings and stuff. Thank you. is not my museum. It's the public's museum, like any museum. And I really feel that it's part of American history and culture and should last long after I'm gone, and that it should be self, you know, independent as a museum, just like any other museum. So I'm still working on that premise that that's what's going to happen, and hopefully with us searching, we'll find another place and somehow find the money to do this, because we are flat busted. I mean, we spent everything on this. We're basically breaking even, keeping the lights on, because we pay for the electric, we pay for the heat, the, you know, all that kind of stuff. We pay for the employees that work here. So it's been a rough go, but any new business, it's tough to get started. You can't become a hit, you know, a big hit in less than a year or something for when people know you. So it's a matter of getting a more permanent location that we can really start to grow from, which was what I hope would happen here. But it's a learning experience. It's one, you know, I wouldn't put on anyone else. But the fact is that we've learned a lot of things by the mistakes that we made. When, you know, we certainly wasn't, it wasn't our fault that the mall was sold and created this, but there were other issues that we could have dealt with better. But the fact is that it's just an unfortunate circumstance. So we have to now, you know, kind of get up off the ground and start all over. At least we know how to do it, because this was our first experience, and it taught us an awful lot of stuff. So, you know, a lot of those fundamental things we're not going to have to go through again when we build a new museum. So that's where we're at. And hopefully we will, by this time next year, be in a new place and running and having less issues than we have now.
That's the end of this episode of Playable Character. We hope you enjoyed your visit to the National Pinball Museum. David Silberman and his crew have gotten that lease extension in writing, and the National Pinball Museum will be open at its current location until September 5th, 2011. Check the show notes at playablecharacter.com for a link to the museum website, where you can get directions and information about visiting. The music for this episode was composed and recorded by animator and musician David Logan. You can also find a link to his site in the show notes. As always, you can keep track of Playable Character on Twitter, where we are at PlayableCHAR, and on our Facebook page, search for Playable Character. If you subscribe to us through iTunes, please consider leaving a review, and if you have any questions, comments, or story ideas, send an email to info@playablecharacter.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Sean Ryder, and this has been Playable Character.